Welcome to our Farm and Water Scotland podcast series. Over this series, we're looking at various mitigation options, guidance and farmers' experience to help manage and improve water quality on farm in the surrounding area. In today's podcast, we'll be discussing invasive species control and around waterways with Struan Candlish from the Ayrshire Rivers Trust and Alex Perry from SEC Consulting. Your host today is myself, Fiona Salter from SEC Consulting. Hi and welcome both. Struan and Alex, do you want to just give yourself a quick introduction to our listeners?
My name is Struan Candlish. I work with Ayrshire Rivers Trust as a fisheries biologist, but it's a very multifaceted job, and as much as we have just come from fish monitoring today, we also have a big role in invasives control across Ayrshire.
Perfect. And Alex?
And yeah, thanks Fiona. My name's Alec Perry, for those of you who haven't heard from me before. I'm a senior agricultural consultant and the area manager for Ayrshire, Renfrewshire and the Islands in the southwest.
Great, thank you. And really to start the conversation, Stuart, do you want to just give us a definition of what invasive species are?
Yeah, so in my mind anyway, it is a plant that is non-native. And then the next step would then be invasive in terms of how rapidly it could spread and colonise an area. And I think from our perspective, waterways are a sort of highway for these things, because if they've got seed or broken stems, like so Japanese knotweed, then it can colonise entire catchments very quickly, at least in a downstream capacity. And then you've still got the issues with wind-borne seeds or animals as vectors for these plants. So most of these things that we're dealing with are brought over in the Victorian period, and we're now dealing with the hangover of that. But yeah, I'll keep it there for what my definition would be.
Perfect. And like with looking especially at the water environment, what are the issues or problems that are caused by these species coming into our environment?
Yeah, it's sometimes a difficult one for people to wrap their head around why we spend so much time, effort and money on this particular problem. But if you take, like the Himalayan balsam, or the big three that we deal with in Ayrshire are Himalayan balsam, Japanese knotweed and giant hogweed. You could also throw skunk cabbage into that mix as well, but we don't have the same problems that some of our catchments do. And these plants die back over the winter period, so as they colonise waterways or just land in general, but particularly river systems, they grow through spring, summer and autumn, and then they die back over winter, and they've outcompeted native flora. And then what you're left with is bare banks as these plants die back over winter. And that's when we're most susceptible to flooding events, what we call spates. And your banks then start to get eroded. You get the soil, the nutrient that's contained within the soil washed into your water course. That depresses water quality. It reduces the quality of the habitat to be able to invertebrates into fish. And then that has an impact on your mammalian life, your bird life. The invertebrates and the fish underpin the sort of trophic levels within the river, and so you get this cascade of problems as a result of a plant, which is why some people kind of struggle with that a little bit, because if it's anglers, they tend to be on the rivers during spring, summer and autumn, maybe not so much over winter, so they don't necessarily see firsthand how damaging it can be. So that's in a nutshell probably why we are as invested in this particular problem as we are.
Mm. No, yeah, because like you see in the spring months like how it just erupts, but like thinking about it, like 365 days a year, it is a year-long problem. That and also like you can't treat it throughout the year as well.
No, you've got quite a short windows for dealing with these plants. We're coming to the end of it for hogweed and for balsam, which are both setting seed at the moment as we speak, and knotweed you've got a slightly longer period to go at it for, but yeah, and then you don't see the plant for the rest of the year, so if it comes out of sight, out of mind, it drops off people's radars. But and it's less and less easy to get funding for these things now as well. 10 years ago, these things were very much in vogue. There was a lot of money being thrown at these problems, and rightly so, but what it needs is the continuity of funding, and as these problems aren't dealt with in 1 to 5 years, you're talking about multi-decade, probably, funding sources, if you're really serious about eradication, which would be the ultimate end goal.
Yeah, we'll talk about like how you treat them and or potential ways to treat them and like the time of years. But like Alex, looking at the actual invasive species, are there any like linked land management problems for within the farming community that these species might impact on farm?
Yeah, so Fiona, just to take a step back here, yep. I think where the spread of these invasive and non-native species occur on farm, it's often the result of the land manager, the farmer, the estate, the crofter, taking a step back and removing agricultural activity from a place. So I always like to frame it as, you know, fencing off a watercourse is great. I want to see more people doing it. Fencing off a woodland, allowing for natural regeneration, is great. But once that fence is up, once that those livestock are excluded, we need to reframe what it means to actively manage these places and mm-hmm. need to maintain a kind of presence in these areas so that these invasive species, like Struan says, can't overtake these really valuable habitats. When we're talking about land management problems, I mean, selfishly, from a subsidy and Scottish Government support perspective, farmers are paid on maintaining their land in good agricultural and environmental condition. And part of that is the management of invasive and non-native species and ensuring that our land can remain productive. And obviously it can't be if we're seeing it colonised by these rapidly progressing species. So from a subsidy perspective, it's disadvantageous to see these species creep onto the farm and become more and more prevalent. Mm-hmm. But also, when you look at the kind of biodiversity story across Scotland's farms and crofts, invasive and non-native species have been linked to biodiversity decline. They're one of the five drivers, depending on which organisations you're working with or making reference to. So we really need to get on top of them for a number of reasons. I don't think that there's one thing in particular that is a big issue. Mm-hmm.
Good, thank you. So there is lots of things that managers can do on farm to help eradicate it. But also we should say that having invasive species on your land isn't like they can travel for miles and get there and just pop up one year that you didn't need to have them. So like being vigilant and acting quickly can help reduce the problem long term because it isn't a quick fix. So if we move back to like the time of year and the treatment, looking at, because obviously from my, like, I don't know much about that. I'm quite interested in this and or in this next stage because my understanding of how you actually treat and remove invasive species, I don't necessarily, rhododendron probably know more than the other species. But you just hear of like some species are really poisonous, some are like you can only do it certain times of year, otherwise you're just going to increase the spread rather than reduce the spread. What time of years could people start thinking about trying to reduce the invasive species on their land? And what kind of precautions do they need to be aware of before starting any project?
So start with Himalayan and balsam, because that is one that anyone really could control. When you start using chemical as an application, as a herbicide, then you're into the training required to administer that. So we'll come on to that. So but balsam, anyone can.
Do you want
to
give a quick description of what it looked like?
Himalayan and balsam, it's at this time of year, if you're on any riverbank in Ayrshire nowadays, unfortunately, it's this pink, purple, white flower. It looks like a bit like an old-fashioned policeman's helmet. You get these stands of sort of that sort of pinky, purpley colour, and it's got quite a soapy smell. It's got quite a distinctive aroma, which mm-hmm. is not unpleasant. Bees, pollinating insects love it, and the argument might be, well, why is that an issue? But it's pulling these pollinating insects onto that plant and leaving the native plants unpollinated. So that's where the issue becomes there. But from a volunteer or people on a riverbank or anywhere standpoint, they can just remove it by pulling the root from the ground and hang up over a fence or a tree branch to desiccate and dry out in the sun and the wind, and that kills the plant. At the moment, we're getting to a stage in the year now where it gets these sort of elongated sort of big seed pods, and they are getting to the point where they're ripe and will be about to burst. And it's sometimes known as jumping jack, because when you brush against the seed pods, you get this burst and it will scatter the seed for up to a couple of metres. And that's how it spreads. And it's very effective at doing that. Now, of course, if it lands on the ground, it will good chance it'll germinate and prop and produce another plant. If it goes into the watercourse, it's where does that then get offloaded onto a riverbank somewhere downstream, and that's how it typically progresses down. The other thing I think is worth mentioning, and this is true of all invasive species, that if you're trying to undertake a controlled strategy on a catchment, then really you want to be working from the top down, but you also need unity and the people that are working on this problem. With the best bill in the world, if you take like the River Ayr as an example at the moment, we're doing some work there on the Balsam front. If you take an isolated kilometre of river in the middle of the affected area and you eradicate the plant within that area, yeah, you've reduced the seed source to some extent, but it's just going to be infiltrated from the top down again. So you really need to start from the top and chase it down. So if you are struggling for money, which is not an uncommon place for boards and rivers trust to be, then maybe you need to focus on just doing a mile 1 year from the top down to the best of your ability, reassess what's there next year, and then chase it a little bit further and accept you're not going to do the full catchment in 1 year. It's a plant that does respond well to a herbicide spraying, and it also responds well to strimming or brush cutting at the right time. And we've examples of this recently where we've gone and brush cut or strimmed areas at the back end of July, just before the seeds are getting to a point where they're ripe and you would be spreading the seed. Mm-hmm. But that's having strimmed it as close to the ground as possibly can, because it will then continue to grow, but there's not enough growing season left now for it to get to a point where it can produce seed. And we've seen some very good results with that. Similarly, spraying would do that in it. It just depends on the circumstance which you're under. Spraying, you're going to have a certain amount of collateral damage and you're going to affect native vegetation. And you've got to weigh up the pros and cons of that. Brush cutting, you're going to level a swathe of ground off, but you're not losing, you're not killing any of the native plants around it. So they'll come back, and as the seed, the life of the seed in the soil of balsam is around about 18 months, you don't need to have too many successive years of really good level of control to make a huge dent in this plant. So in some ways, it's of the big three, if you like, it's the easiest on paper to control. But the way it spreads and gets in through hedgerows and trees and bushes, when you actually face with being on the ground, you look at it and you think, maybe this isn't the one that's on paper the easiest to do. It can be a really hellish job.
It gets everywhere.
Yeah, it gets everywhere. Mm-hmm. It gets there quickly.
And looking at just talking about spraying herbicides, is that kind of licensed sprayer and following, because obviously it's near water, so spraying near water comes with its own rules and regulations as well.
So I can speak to spraying in and around water, or administering any herbicide in and around water. And there's a couple of things here. One, there's really one product on the market that you can use, and that's Roundup ProVantage 480, which is formulated for use in and around water. Some people have applications where they want to spray off like water wells or something like that in a pond situation. That's the product you can use to do that. And if you're working on riverbanks, then that's the product you can use. The other side of this is, training-wise, you require PA6AW, the AW standing for around water. That goes for if you're using a knapsack sprayer, or if we're stem injecting, like that's what we do for knotweed, and to a certain extent hogweed as well nowadays. And that's what's required.
Oh, that's really great. And then if you want to talk about knotweed, I suppose.
Yeah, so we deal with Japanese knotweed, and the one thing I would say on in the knotweed front nowadays is that we stem inject, and that means you inject a mil and a half of neat glyphosate Roundup ProVantage 480 into individual stems of that plant. We don't spray anymore. We learned enough through a project called CURB, which I can't remember what the acronym stands for. It was before my time, but it was a European funded project. And we saw stands of knotweed regrowing maybe 3 or 4 years down the line. So initially, like, you've eradicated this plant in a certain area, but the reality is there'll be regrowth at some point in the future. And, you know, if we were putting the time, effort and money into this, we'd rather go the labour-intensive route, and it is much more labour-intensive.
Yeah, it sounds it. Yeah.
It's quite slow, not gonna lie, it's tedious.
Because it's not like it's easy terrain either. So
no, I mean, you spend a lot of your day in your hands and knees looking at what looks like bamboo. Mm-hmm. But our experience is that it's far more effective and longer lasting, because we haven't seen problems with regrowth. And so that's what we do. So, I mean, like, so on the River Stinshire, where they've got an extensive Japanese knotweed problem, we've actually managed to secure funding for this year going forward for the next 3 years to do far more extensive control, because that was something that the National Salmon Fishery Board was putting a good chunk of its resource into each year, paying us to have some of our staff spend how many days a year injecting. So we've been able to supplement that, if you like, and try and go far wider reaching with it and make more of a hit, because it just requires that consistency of control. The good thing on the whole about Japanese knotweed, if it's left undisturbed, be it man or river, it doesn't tend to go too far in our experience. It's when you get fragments being broken off by spates or by people strimming paths into it, it can reproduce from that those little bits of vegetation that are broken up. Mm-hmm. It can survive in salt water. And
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and I'm not sure how true this is, but I was in Arran on Sunday and was admiring the large amounts of balsam and knotweed. And it could well be that, I'm not sure where the balsam come from, but the amount of knotweed that could have come from an Ayrshire River, gone across the Firth and settled out there at some point. Now, that I've heard that said before. I'm not sure if it's true. I'm not sure if it's gone in on a machinery or soil at some point in the past, which may be more likely. But yeah, it's a plant that's built to last, and it's one that scares people to death when they have it on their property. Because it can make it
better.
Is
that the one that can go through walls and?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's quite easy to deal with by stem injection, but if you get it on property, it makes it very difficult to get a mortgage or to sell a house. So that's, and by and large, external contractors are not afraid to charge handsomely for trying to do something with it. And typically that means spraying multiple times through a season. Whereas we say you get it to a good growing size, you want a cane that's at least the thickness of a finger, and then you can put a needle into it and that's how we deal with it now, and we won't do anything else going forward. It's just, it's not worth putting chemical into the environment if it's not going to do the job in which it's intended.
Yeah. So you found when you're injecting that, how many years will you have to go back and treat that area? Or is it too new to tell?
No, it depends a little bit on the size of the stand. So I mean, if you've got a, what we call a stand, and that's got, say it's got 2,000 canes in it, what you don't want to do is crawl about it and break all the canes in, on your way to get into the middle. So something you work from the outside in, give it a couple of weeks, let it die off outside, and so working sort of concentric circles until you get to the centre and you feel like you've had that hit on it. Or it may be you can only do so much in year before you have to go back in year two. It just depends.
And I think, Struan, just to build off that point there, I mean, some listeners to this podcast might hear us talking about chemical control and think, oh no, you know, around the water environment, surely that's damaging to some extent. But there is the damage that occurs if we do nothing. I mean, a lot of these plants are very shallow rooting. They'll be very damaging to kind of soil structure on the top of banks. I mean, presumably you see soil erosion occur, and part of that will be down to these invasive species.
No, absolutely. And while we look at it more from the catchment perspective and what it does there, it's also, from a landowner's perspective, land loss. Because once you start that erosion process, it can be quite hard to stop. And if you've got a riverbank which it doesn't have much to wear trees or other vegetation with good root structure there to hold that banking together, once you get a weakness, you know, water's that thing that just works 24 hours a day all year round, and it will find a way. And so if you've got a banking that's lacking that root structure, but you've got lots of invasives of some description on it, like you say, it's only going to go one way, and you can't do much until you've controlled the invasive. So it's a very difficult, it can be a difficult problem to solve. The reality of it is, if you know what you're doing, you've got a contractor or you're capable of doing it yourself to a high standard, then it's very dealable with.
But actually, I mean, to your point again, like I've seen some farms just in the last 12 months there where erosion has become a real problem, and it would really scare you how quickly your banking can totally fall away and fundamentally change the layout of your field.
Yeah. No, we don't see it to that extent too often nowadays, but there are certainly places where that is true.
Obviously, Struan, you've mentioned a lot of the work that you are doing in the Ayrshire Rivers Trust, but do you want to talk about any of the projects in more depth and like who you're working with and how successful or lessons learned that you have had? I know you've mentioned a few already, but things that people can learn from.
The other one I think is worth discussing quickly is the giant hogweed in the River Ayr. We haven't really come onto hogweed yet, and that's the plant that has a threat to human health, because if you brush up against a plant, you get any sap in your skin, and it really just has to be the merest of grazes at times on a plant. It strips your skin's ability to buffer the UV light, and in the worst case, if people just have to Google this and be warned, it's not pretty. It can be quite it's been quite brutal. People end up with third-degree burns
from the plant,
arms and legs. If you don't know the plant, it's
because it's the one that grows really, really tall with the big, like lily-pad leaves.
Yeah, you get these massive white umbrellas of flowers. It's an incredibly how to describe it. It's a very impressive plant. The rate at which it grows during the growing season, it'll do inches in a day. And we also get native hogweed, which is a good deal smaller, but you sometimes see a large native hogweed plant and a small invasive hogweed, and you could confuse the two almost. So that's the kind of health hazard point of it. And when you get dense stands of it, if it's on paths or areas where people are trying to frequent, then they're just no-go zones, because the potential for really nasty and lifelong burns is definitely there. We deal with that on the River Ayr. It's on all the Ayrshire rivers with the exception of the Stinshire and the Girvan, the two southerly rivers. And we've been controlling it in the River Ayr now for, this is the 18th year which we've done it. We've done that with funding in the early days from external funders. More recently, it's the District Salmon Fishery Board through the dangling levy system. They distribute money to us to do that. And we've got a certain amount of our own time and effort in this one as well, because we're very grateful for the board for putting up the cash to do it, but it only goes so far. And I think when we tally up, and I haven't done it yet this year, but once we look at the timesheets for it, it extends past what they're capable of giving us. But because we've got 18 years now of successive control, we can't see it go wrong for the sake of an extra couple of days to control the plants. And so we've gone from huge stands of it, and I remember it as a child, because it was 18 years ago and I'm only 33, where it was just dense, and at that point in my life I didn't know what it was, but I remember quite how massive these plants were and quite how far reaching they were. And there still are the old signage from the council saying don't go into this area because of giant hogweed. Fortunately, that is a thing of the past. It's throughout the catchment. It comes in the bog and burn up at Catron. So we cover from there down to the estuary, and there are plants all through that, but much less. The banks are much less densely populated than they ever were before. And in terms of control for this plant, we do spot spraying with herbicide. Again, same product. And in the last few years, we've also been doing more stem injection, as we've been finding that we've had some slightly mixed results with the giant hogweed in terms of plants coming back where we feel like they've been controlled previously.
Do you think it's a different strain or just the government?
This is something we're exploring with a few people at the moment. And to be honest, I don't have the answer on it. We just know that there's inconsistencies sometimes in the reactions that we see. So it looks like the plant dies back 1 year, and given the fact it's the same cohort of people that are doing the control each year, we tend to put people back onto the same areas that they did the previous year, because they've got the knowledge and they can then feed back what they're seeing, and we're finding plants that we reckon were sprayed the previous year looks like they've been killed. But these things are like icebergs, are 9/10 submerged, and hogweed isn't an you've got year one when you've got a sort of sapling stage, and then unlikely to flower and produce seed until years three or four. I think it's what they call monocarpic. But if it's grazed or if it's stressed due to water or lack of water, or someone batters it with a stick or something like that, it stresses its life mission is to produce seed. So it will do that. So you can find plants that are quite small, and you can find plants that are 3-4 meters tall. And we'll either spray those or we'll inject them. And the overriding goal for us in a control season is to make sure that we don't get any flowering plants, because we want to make sure that people are safe across the catchment. So we'll spray off as much as possible, but the main thing is to prevent any seed source going back into the environment. If we can prevent that happening, then we're just using up a seed bank that's in existence. And the slightly disturbing thing here is that there's places where we know nothing has seeded in 18 years categorically, and yet you'll still maybe get one plant or two plants a year germinating and popping their heads up. And it's difficult because we're at the sharp end of this. There's the Tweed Commission, I think it is, or the Tweed Forum, have been controlling this planet for 1 year longer than us in a continuous fashion. So they've been at it for 19 years, I think, and we've been at it for 18. And so we're not quite sure at what point the seeds are no longer viable in the soil. Certainly up to years 18, there's still the potential for that to occur. You look online, people say all sorts of things, but they don't say getting on for two decades. So we're still on a fact-finding mission with this plant to a large extent, but we keep fighting each year.
But hopefully you're on winning now.
I think on balance we definitely are. Right. It's just you feel like, sometimes you do feel like we could be further ahead if there weren't some of these inconsistent results, but well, we've been speaking to a few parties and Bayer, who own the company that makes the product, to try and get a better understanding of some of these results.
How has the recent weather, does that have an impact? Like the past few summers have been quite, I know Ayrshire might not be the same, but like the dryness and like the heavy intense rainfalls at a certain time of year and then the longer spells of dry weather.
It probably doesn't have too much impact on it from our control standpoint. It just means that things will either grow a little bit more quickly or a little bit more slow, but you're only talking about a week or two difference in the window. Probably what has more impact is that if you get like sort of knotweed grows well early in the season and it's dry, and then you get one of these big spates that comes down and crushes plants and breaks plants, and then starts to spread that further downstream. That's probably the more the concern from our perspective. And so there's certain sections or whatever that we try to get it onto sooner rather than later, so that you're not having these issues. But I mean, we're trying to cover big areas here, and we'd love to do more across all of Ayrshire, but there's just not the funding there to allow us to cover 6 main river catchments and a good number of coastal ones as well, which all suffer from similar problems.
It's not a quick fix.
It really requires an army, and because you've got a limited control window each year, it just makes that a little bit more difficult.
And like following on from that, like Alex, what can land managers do to help long term, short term?
So we're seeing the development of some really exciting farm clusters around about Scotland, which is great. I do wonder whether there's a role for something like that to kind of, I don't know, take root, for lack of a better word, across the country. I mean, I quite regularly have discussions with our local Nature Scot team, which I know Struan's familiar with as well. I mean, we quite often have discussions about the development of some kind of invasive species inventory so that we can map the location of these species and get a better idea of where they're becoming problems. But I mean, Struan set it out really nicely there, and it is a really complicated issue. There's no silver bullet. There's no easy answer. It does just require that consistency. I mean, there are funding mechanisms out there, the likes of the Nature Restoration Fund. I know that it's closed for applications right now. The Agri-Environment Climate Scheme, we've just seen the 2026 funding round come to a close. There are opportunities out there in the right locations for some local funding as well. So it's about being strategic, understanding what support's available and collaborating with your neighbours wherever possible.
Yeah, I think that's very true, and it's collaboration and this is the key, because it's we undertake it, the hogweed in the entirety of the catchment for the river Ayr, and we just about manage that each year. But beyond that, I mean, we're only a team of six, but beyond that, we don't have the capacity to take on any more for this stuff. And I suppose the other thing that's worth highlighting before we wrap up here is that the way the law works with us under the Wildlife and Natural Environment 2011 Act, the Wayne Act, it's down to individual landowners to prevent or stop the spread of these plants. Now, stop the spread means stop seeds being dispersed out with your landholding or how it's categorised. it's legislation that has never been held up in court. But that's when people come and ask us, well, what happens if I don't? Say, well, that's the way the law works with this. But if anyone does have any further questions or wants specific advice, they are very welcome to get in touch with us at Ayrshire Rivers Trust. And, you know, even if it's something, if we can't take it on for somebody, we can certainly give them advice. But we do quite a lot of work for private landowners, specifically with Japanese knotweed, because that tends to be the one people get most concerned about. And it's better to do something with it than to leave it and allow it to kind of rampage over ground.
No, you just answered my last question, was what happens if we do nothing, but you've answered that.
You just end up with monocultures of these plants, and they can take over very quickly. All you need to do is, if you're uncertain what Timoleon balsam looks like, Google it and then go for a walk on your local river if you're in Ayrshire. I'd be very surprised if you're not inundated with it.
Yeah. There's a plant invasive species technical document that I will put on the notes at the bottom of the podcast, so that I have all the pictures of the different species, so you will be able to go and click on them and then check. And actually right now, one thing I find, like on your phone, if you take a picture of a plant and swipe up, a lot of phones nowadays will tell you what that plant is. Because right. I've been near a river and I was like, oh, okay, shouldn't walk through that. So then you go around it. But I just find that really, I don't know if it's on every feature, but it's on my phone. So but you can do that and then you can find out what it is when you're out and about and avoid it or report it if needed.
I mean, the one thing I was going to kind of round off there was, like, in terms of what happens if we do nothing, you used the word there, Struid, monoculture. We end up with huge areas of the farmed landscape that we can't claim, that's nature poor, that's, well, damaging to livestock, to health, to soil. We can't allow that to happen.
No, I think that's very true. It's a tough one, because sometimes when we're doing this, because we spend so much time in the year doing it, you sort of think, maybe we should just leave it. Maybe we've lost the war here. But you do get a bit demoralised at times. But I think, on the whole, you kind of got to keep fighting the good fight, as Ian Cornforth would say.
You've got to lose well rather than win badly.
Yeah, and I mean, It sometimes feels like the effort when you spend 2 hours doing something and then you look up and you see there's still how much to go, and you're like, oh, where do we even go from here? But actually, it's only year to year. And then when you look back at photos from 5 years ago, 10 years ago, you're like, actually, you know what? This is all going the right direction. It might not be as fast as you'd like it to, but I think sometimes any progress is good progress, and it's better to bear that in mind.
And I do think, so this ties into something that I mentioned earlier, but do you know, if Scottish government are looking for us to reverse nature decline and tackle climate change, you know, these riparian areas are quite often the most nature-rich areas that a lot of farmers have, particularly here in Ayrshire, where we've got kind of high-intensity dairy country. These should be the easy wins for farmers to be managing sustainably and to a high standard. And if we just kind of let them go by the wayside, it's just a bit sad. It's an easy win that we've kind of let go of.
Yeah, it's got the potential to tick so many boxes. And for flora, for fauna, these sort of transitional habitats, the wildlife corridors, like in the water environment. Yeah, they really do hold a key where other areas maybe don't.
Thank you, Struan and Alex. That was really, really interesting. I learned a lot today, and yeah, definitely will be a lot more vigilant when walking through areas near water, especially if it's over my head, about what the actual plant is. And thank you for joining us today. We'll save all the information about further information to invasive species on the website. And please get in touch if you want to find out anything else, either from Farm Water Scotland or from Struan. I can put the link to their website on the notes as well. If you've enjoyed listening, please like, subscribe and follow our podcast wherever you listen to them. You can listen back to all previous podcast episodes we produce for Farming Water Scotland on any podcast provider. Farming Water Scotland is funded by Scottish Government and delivered by SEC Consulting in partnership with CFAF to help farmers and land managers reduce diffuse pollution risk and benefit the farm business.